Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Hello, good morning. Welcome.
Whoa.
How you doing? This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We broadcast from the unceded ancestral territory of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. I'm Jesse, here every Thursday to share a little bit of talk with you. And this week we have a cool interview that contributor Xenia did with Darren Byler, who's an assistant professor in the Department of International Studies here at SFU, about, his expertise is sort of China and international relations and surveillance in China. And Xenia was really interested in the wake of the sort of ongoing global pivot away from America in international relations and the seeking of other partners and the sort of desire or the what seems to be happening, the move towards China, and sort of what implications that might have. So we'll get into that. It's going to take up the majority of today's program, but there will also be time for some other things, including music, which is where we always start here on my Thursday episode of Speak Up, with a little bit of local music. And we're going to hear from this artist called Spoil Sport. They just put out a couple of demos called Piano Demos. This one is called Apartments.
Take it all back.
Except when somebody walks by with a suitcase, and for a minute I feel cool.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of the community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.
Welcome back to the program. Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, in case you forgot. I'm Jesse, also in case you forgot. You just heard music from Spoilsport, a demo called Apartments. And now we're going to move on to the main attraction of today's show, an interview that contributor Senya did with Darren Beiler, who's an assistant professor in the Department of International Studies here at SFU. This interview is pretty wide-ranging, but focuses on China, Canada's relationship with China, the how that might change, how that perhaps should or shouldn't change, and a bunch of other stuff. So without further ado, let's get right into it.
My name is Darren Beiler. I'm an associate professor in the School for International Studies at Simon Fraser University. I study migration and labor and surveillance in China. And more recently, been looking more directly at surveillance and safe city systems and how they move through China and outside of China.
And how long have you been like studying China in particular?
Well, that's a good question. I guess maybe since my undergrad, so 2003.
Oh, wow.
But I've been going to China as a researcher maybe for the last 10 years, 15 years. The last time I was there was actually 2018, so it's been a bit of time over the last decade or so.
Interesting. So I guess my question will be about the surveillance system in general, since that's what you mostly study. How would you define a surveillance state, and how would that apply to China?
Well, I mean, in the broadest sense, a modern state is a surveillance state. Any state that has a modern police force is also going to be able to conduct forms of surveillance on its population. The difference maybe is that in some states, surveillance is really used only to investigate crimes after the fact, whereas in other states, it's used in real time to monitor people and to track their movements and behavior and to predict what they're going to do next. And it seems increasingly like those two kinds of states are beginning to merge into one, that there's increasing forms of surveillance. And that has to do with changes in the way the technology works, that it's just much more sophisticated than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And it also, it has to do with the changing political dynamics in the world.
And with the modern surveillance technology currently being in use, do you think that having surveillance makes the state safe or not?
Well, that's the argument, is that having more surveillance will create greater forms of security, greater forms of safety for populations. That's what the Chinese state would say. So they would say they're creating safety and security for the majority, which is the Han majority group and also the middle class. But of course, that means that it's making the life for dissidents, for minorities, for targeted groups or disfavored groups much less safe. So it goes in both directions. Often when we're talking about security, we're talking about protecting property, protecting wealth, and protecting the rights of those that already have power. I think it might be better to think about, you know, what do communities themselves need or want, ask them what they want rather than assume from above what they want. Often surveillance is really about concentrating power. It's mm-hmm. about securing the authority and regime that's in power.
And next question will be more like China specific. Looking at your work, you have worked with the Uyghur population to disclose the high technology that is used in these internment camps. And with AI now on the rise, do you think it has gotten more repressive?
AI has accelerated the intimate forms of violence that surveillance has perpetrated in the world. I mean, having a passbook, having walls and gates and, you know, people watching you, an overseer, which is, you know, that's what the term surveillance really means, is oversight. It's a plantation technology that was, you know, first really institutionalized in slave plantations. That's always been violent. But what once all of your behavior, everything you do online, your biometrics, which is your face, your DNA, your fingerprints, your voice print, are being tracked without your consent, it means that there's less of an outside to the system. And so for targeted groups like the Uyghurs in Northwest China, it means that they are living within a carceral system, a prison state. Whether or not they're in actual physical confinement, the digital confinement around them prevents them from moving. It shapes their behavior. It is, you know, with them wherever they are.
And is the surveillance in China primarily political, economic, or security driven, or all three?
I think it's always wise to not assume there's a single cause of something, like a big structure, like a surveillance state system or apparatus. There's an economic incentive. So there's a business lobby in China that's saying, we can build these new tools for you at this price, and it will also benefit our national economy. And of course, will benefit that company because they'll be able to develop new AI tools that go beyond surveillance to fintech or financial technology applications or other commercial applications. And so it's about, you know, China is developing its economy. So there's a whole sales pitch that's part of this. And then sometimes they're selling things that they actually can't do yet. But once they get the money, once they get the data, then they maybe will be able to. So there is a business element to it. There's also, from the state's perspective, an element of regime security. The Xi Jinping administration is an authoritarian state. Of course, it's like a minority relative to the total population. So they need to be able to monitor and control populations and create a kind of narrative around state protection of the majority. And so it's bolstering state control and regime security. There's a geopolitical element to it as well, where it's about competition with the United States for supremacy and AI development. So there's lots and lots of different kinds of drivers. There's a geopolitical one as well, which is about, you know, this is a border region. The Uyghur region is a border region with Central Asia and with Pakistan. China's wanting to develop Afghanistan, get access to natural resources there. So securing a region at home also means that they can then project power outside of China to a greater degree.
So from what I can tell, there's also like a nationalistic element from China's part, right?
Yeah, there's a kind of pride that the tech engineers have, that the state has, that the sort of settler population of Han people that have moved to this region have, where they feel like, this is a sign that China is becoming more and more sophisticated, that it's becoming, it's like, you know, it's at the cutting edge of counterterrorism. It's now marketing its counterterrorism tools to countries all over the world. It's competing with Israel and with the United States for the the role of being sort of the police tech and military technology provider to the world.
Mm. And with China's surveillance, how does the system affect like minorities, not just Uyghur people, but like other minorities like Tibetan people, Mongols, other minorities in China?
Well, the Uyghurs have been kind of singled out as part of what the state has called the People's War on Terror because of their size as a group, because of their connections to the Islamic world, because they are Muslim. Terrorism today is often associated with Muslim populations. And so I would say that the security state, you know, that apparatus is focused most intensely on the Uyghurs. But of course, if you go to Tibet or to Inner Mongolia, which is what the Chinese state would call the Mongol homeland, they're also being targeted. Both of those three groups are some of the larger groups and of minorities in China and are less assimilated. Like they speak their own language, they have their own homeland, they have claims to sovereignty because they're indigenous nations, and so they're seen as most threatening to the state. They're also in border regions, which as China is trying to expand out of you know, into other parts of Asia. They have to go through those spaces. Mm. And so they're the most targeted today, I would say, of the groups in China. But actually, like, you know, labor rights activists, queer activists, feminist activists, democracy rights activists, Christians, they're all being targeted by the state. Not to quite the same degree, perhaps. But no one feels free to practice those faiths or those political beliefs in public. They have to keep them very hidden, and that means even hidden online, so because that's where the surveillance is happening.
Okay, but with Uyghurs being targeted the most, would you say that there's definitely like some kind of Islamophobia behind this as well from China's part?
Oh, absolutely. Now, part of the counterterrorism law that was put in motion in 2017 was about targeting Islam directly, talking about Islam as a virus, as something that was spreading tumors, a cancer in the society, that there was a pan-halalification infection that was moving from the Uyghurs into the rest of the Chinese population. They would say that kind of Islam was foreign Islam, which was Islam that was not censored or controlled by the state. But really, they're talking about normal Islam. They're talking about fasting during Ramadan, which is, you know, coming up now. It's you know, praying five times a day. It's, you know, having an Islamic marriage or funeral. Like, those are what they're saying is a cancer because it's outside of state control. So in that sense, it's one of the most deeply Islamophobic states in the world.
Okay, wow. And one last question before I move on to the next. There are some people who say that what's happening to Uyghurs is like fake news. Would you say that these people are obviously like uneducated or ignorant in this case because there's evidence of China doing this?
Well, I mean, there may be some ignorance, maybe some willful ignorance, but there's also a Chinese state media apparatus that's very powerful. And has now moved in many different domains. It's not just, you know, the newspaper or the television. It's, you know, what you're seeing on a social media app. It's vlogger content, that sort of thing. That is, you know, presenting disinformation or misinformation about what's going on. It's showing maybe tourist sites in the region, and that, you know, you don't see police. People look happy, so. Therefore, what's implied is that nothing is happening here. And then they might also even say that. They may get Uyghurs, other people from the region, to say the same things. But that's ignoring the fact, according to the state documents, that around 600,000 people have been formally prosecuted in the region since 2017, and that they have assigned around 3 million people to jobs. That's their way of framing a kind of unfree labor system where Uyghurs have no choice but to go wherever they're told to work, in securitized factories apart from their families. They're also not pointing out that there's 800,000 children in residential schools at this moment. So all of those, you know, institutional facts of violence that some of, you know, is according to the United Nations meets the definition of crimes against humanity. You know, that's something that you're not going to see in a vlog post that's celebrating what's going on, according to a Chinese perspective. And then there's like, it's a big country. Like, you know, there's other parts of the country that look quite different. There are other Muslim groups, the Hui Muslim group, who hasn't been targeted to quite the same degree. And they speak Chinese. They can pass as Han. They don't have their own homeland. They're in some ways less connected to other parts of the world, other parts of the Muslim world. And so there's lots of ways that you can kind of spin a narrative that would try to dismiss this. But to do that, you're ignoring the facts on the ground. You're ignoring the voices of Uyghurs who are in diaspora, whose family members are in these camps or in prison.
And I know it's not just Uyghurs. There's also the Kazakh minority as well has been also persecuted by the Chinese state, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the Uyghur region has around 15 million Muslim people in it. Around 12 million of them are Uyghur. And then there's a million and a half that are Kazakh and another million that are Hui, which is a Chinese Muslim group. The Uyghurs are, you know, their ancestral homeland is in the southern part of the region, which is a very large space. It's, you know, probably as nearly the same size as British Columbia. And so in the north of the region, which is on the border with Kazakhstan, that's where the Kazakh population lives. In those areas, Kazakhs and Hui people were also targeted. And it seemed because like the local authorities were given a mandate to find 15% of the adult population that are extremists or terrorists. And so if you don't have Uyghurs to frame in that way, then you need to find the next available Muslims, which are Kazakhs and Hui people. Many of the Kazakhs were detained because they had used WhatsApp to contact their family members in Kazakhstan, or they had traveled to Kazakhstan, which is a banned, you know, it's a flagged country because it's a Muslim majority country. Very, you know, arbitrary application of law, not even law, was used to make these decisions to detain people, to send them to factories, all of that. It's really part of an internal colonial project of removing the indigenous population, these Muslim peoples, from their land and opening up that land for a settler population.
And moving on to Canada comparisons, seeing how surveillance has been rising, do you think Canada could apply this as well? And if so, how would it look like? And can it still be democratic while applying it without sliding into authoritarianism?
You're asking if Canada can apply surveillance?
Yeah.
Use surveillance here?
Yeah.
And without it moving towards authoritarianism?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, Canada is already using surveillance to a certain degree. Mostly it's being used in crime investigation. But it's also being used to vet you know, migrants, asylum seekers, people coming into the country. As part of background checks, there's the capacity here already. Like, if the law changed, if a switch was flipped, that we could be tracked to a significant degree. So, you know, our license plates can be read as we're driving down the street. There's face recognition capacity, especially in high density areas like in downtown Vancouver. So they could begin tracking people's movements if the system changed. I think there's a significant concern around that among Canadian lawmakers that not happen. And so there are a lot of safeguards, political safeguards in place that prevent the most egregious forms of abuse that surveillance can be used to do, used to enact. In the United States, I think it is rapidly moving more towards the Chinese position, where they're now tracking people's political speech, they're searching people's phones, they're building databases, of people that protest or undocumented people. It's very alarming to see that democratic backsliding. I think Canada so far has not looked as though it wants to move down that path. Instead, it's trying to distance itself from the United States in some ways. But of course, we're part of the same intelligence establishment. We're part of the Five Eyes. We share information with the U.S. at times, at least, and it's very troubling.
The United States has actually started implementing real surveillances, because I have heard about them tracking phones, but that's actually a real thing that's happening.
Well, they're searching people's phones as they enter the border at spot checks. I don't know that they're tracking people as they regular citizens as they move through space to know where they are in real time. I think if you're on a watch list, that's definitely possible that they would be doing that kind of tracking. And some of it, they are using a legal frame that would allow them to target non-citizens. So if you're, an international student, for instance, then you can be tracked in a way that a citizen is not supposed to be tracked without a warrant or without the right paperwork, permission from a judge. For undocumented people, they are definitely tracking them. Yes, mm-hmm. for sure. And, they force people as they come into the country to download an app onto their phone called CBP1, which is using face recognition, and then is can be used to track people's movements as they enter the country, who they're connecting with, their social network. It's then used as ICE is doing these raids in different locations. That's the kind of information that they're drawing on to decide where they should target people. There's a lot of opacity in how, all the operational uses of this technology, but there's, the contracts are there. We know that they are using these kinds of tools. It's more the specificities and the scale at which they're using them that is less clear.
And since Canada is choosing China primarily because China's economy is powerful and moving from the United States, however, due to China's human rights violations, should Canada reconsider, or should they separate human rights concerns from trade relations?
I mean, that's a tough question. I guess there's a couple ways to answer it. One is that my personal view is that I wouldn't buy things from China personally, and don't think Canadians should. At the same time, the canola business is a $5 billion business. And if you're not able to trade with China, send that to China, that's going to really hurt the economy and hurt specific people. People will lose their jobs. I don't think that moving towards China is a long-term strategy. I think it's not the path we want to head down. If we need to diversify our economy, we should move in different directions and build alliances with nations that don't have horrific human rights records, where they're actively interning populations, where they're unapologetically doing that. The specific aspect of your question is should it be separated? I think we should have economic sanctions on China, in the same way that the United States has done that. I don't know what it means to sanction a country and then also trade with them. So to me, it feels like that there could be a different strategy that we would want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone else wants our canola. We should be finding other people to trade with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Canada has also diversified its trade with the European Union and other Asian countries. Could they just continue doing that instead of trading with China?
I mean, I think that's a possibility. It's just that the Chinese state is one of the largest economies in the world. It's one of the largest populations in the world. And I think there's not really other states where they have sort of the market capacity to absorb what Canadians are making. Canada has built relationships, new trade agreements with states like Korea,